I think Friday, isn't it, dear Alita? Friday is the first exam. So some of you came after I explained about the exam. So today we'll begin with text number 16. So last week we finished 16 verses. And this week approximately the same or maybe some more. So the exam will be that you pick one of the verses we've covered thus far. Rather, by the time we reach the end of the week, you pick one of those verses, one that means something special to you, one that inspires you, and you write something about that. So today we'll start with text number 16. Yes? Okay. We didn't, huh? All right, we'll do 15. Thank you, Mother Sharanagati. Okay, so one's birth is successful if he brings glory to his dynasty. Otherwise, one is born and dies uselessly in this changing world. So taking birth is not important, but making good use of your birth, our birth, that is important. One who takes birth has to die, but those who perform pious deeds are remembered even after death, and thus their birth is successful. The lives of those who are busy enjoying their senses have no value. Yasya kirti sajivati. Fame offers one life after death. One lives on through his good name. People take instructions from one whose life was ideal and try to follow in his footsteps. A short and glorious life is better than a long and useless one. The most glorious thing one can do for his dynasty or his family is become a famous devotee of the Lord. Of course, that is our... Otherwise, this verse has a very mundane connotation. We're not interested in bringing mundane fame to our family members. And if we fail, as many of us have, to bring some kind of material fame to our families, that does not mean our birth is useless, because the highest fame... is if one becomes a famous devotee. If one becomes a famous devotee, then he's actually done a very great service to his family. Not that we should be inspired to look for fame, but famous devotee, what would be the qualities? What are the qualities that give fame to a devotee? Janmasmi Prabhu? Yeah, humility. Humility. Also, there's, especially in our society, when we think of, let's take for a minute in ISKCON, who is the most famous? I'm talking about, everyone has heard of him. He's a very famous devotee in our movement. Who does that bring to your mind? A very famous devotee. Sorry?
Jayananda.
And so I was thinking the same thing. Jayananda Prabhu. And what were his qualities? He was very humble, and more than humble, or not more, but I'm another great thing he's thought of is being, he had a service attitude. He was always serving the devotees. And he would not like to hear people refer to him as a famous devotee. But actually, he's actually a very famous devotee. When we were in Denver last summer, we had a program where it was Disappearance Day of Jayananda Prabhu. And there was some devotees who had worked with him. What's this devotee's name? One of our godbrothers gave a very heartfelt remembrance. Not a Purva. I can't remember his name, but anyway, he really glorified him nicely because of these qualities of being very humble and having a service attitude. So that's what makes one a famous devotee. It's not that one has some charisma or some talent, some material talent, but that he's actually has an attitude of serving the devotees, and he has and he's actually humble. So the forefathers dance in ecstasy when they see someone in their family become a devotee, as a devotee is most peaceful and always works for the welfare of others. He can deliver his forefathers from material bondage. When Nardushinga killed the demon Hiranyakasipu, he asked Prahlad to take a benediction from him. Prahlad asked that Nrsingadev deliver his father. The Lord said, Nrsingadev said that Prahlad's forefathers for 21 generations had been delivered because of Prahlad's devotional service. So Lord Nrsingadev said, your father's already delivered, and actually 21 generations of your whole family is delivered because of your devotional service. So therefore, even though some of our ancestors, like Hiranyakasipu, he did not appreciate Prahlad Maharaj's devotional service, nevertheless it had a very powerful effect on liberating him. So therefore, we should not be disheartened or discouraged if our family do not approve of our engaging in devotional service. If we actually perform proper devotional service, if we actually do it without any motive, and it will have a very powerful effect in delivering them. So text number 16. When the pious are counted, and the pencil does not record the son's name first, and yet she who has borne him is called mother, then who is deemed barren? So the whole idea is, if a woman gives birth to a son, and he is not famous among pious people, then it's as though she's barren. You know, her son is then not considered worth anything, and therefore she's considered barren. A mother undergoes hard labor during bearing and rearing a son, and if he becomes greatly pious and learned, her labor is considered successful. If he does not, however, she is considered no better than a barren woman. Indeed, it is better to be barren and forego the useless labor. If a son neither brings glory to the family nor cares for the parents, it would have been better not to have had such a son. It is foolish to perform hard labor for no good result. Therefore, if parents want to make their labor useful, they should offer their sons, or daughters also, they should offer their children good education. This is the key to actually making the son worthwhile. Text number 17. These are all in the same theme. One whose mind is not enthusiastic to offer charity, perform austerities, engage in valorous deeds to acquire knowledge or wealth, is indeed the excrement of his mother. Srila Prabhupada used this verse, or he said, and he quoted it a different way, like putra and mutra. Putra means son, he said, putra, and mutra means urine. So if a son is not a scholar or a devotee, then he's considered to be mutra, the waste of his mother, the excrement of his mother. By nature's arrangement, the body naturally rejects excrement. If a son does not have the above qualities, that means he's not enthusiastic to give charity, perform austerities, he's not enthusiastic to engage in valorous deeds, or to acquire knowledge or wealth, then he's considered the refuse of his mother's body. The difference is that the parent is not attached to his excrement, yet he considers the useless son, even a useless son, as his very self. Thus one continues to suffer from the activities of such a wretched son. Now, one might think there's a statement that even excrement is better than a useless son. Because at least excrement you can use for fertilizer. But a useless son, as we heard about Dundukadi, the useless son of Atmadev, he can actually bring destruction to the family. Or, if you remember in Mahabharata, when Duryodhan was born, there was some inauspicious omen. Who remembers that inauspicious omen? A donkey was braying at the time of Duryodhan's birth. And that is considered a very inauspicious omen. It's like comets falling from the sky, or if the earth is trembling. These are inauspicious omens. If the right side of a woman, like if a right arm of a woman, a right leg, a right eye twitches, that's considered an inauspicious sign. Whereas if the left side of the woman's body twitches, that's considered auspicious. and opposite for the man. So when the ass, when at the time Duryodhana is coming out of the womb, a donkey or an ass was braying. So Vidura, who knows these signs of what's called, what we call omens, cheshtas, I think in Sanskrit they're called cheshtas. So he knew that science, and so when Duryodhana was born, he recommended to Dhritarashtra, this son that was just born, because this ill omen appeared at the same time. It signifies that this son is going to destroy the whole family. He's going to bring about destruction of the whole dynasty. So better you kill him. Best thing is you kill this boy. And Dhritarashtra, because he was attached to his son, it was actually, you know, he had 100 sons, and Duryodhana was the first one, so even though he knew this is correct advice Vidura is giving, he could not follow it. And so consequently, Duryodhana destroyed the whole dynasty, just as Vidura predicted. So therefore, this confirms that a useless son is even worse than excrement. So text number 18. It is better to have one learned son than hundreds of foolish ones. One moon is able to dispel the darkness while millions of stars cannot. There's no 18 in the book. Oh, I'm sorry. All right. That's an oversight. So thank you. Anyway, this verse also Srila Prabhupada has quoted. It's better to have one learned son than hundreds of foolish ones. The moon is able to dispel the darkness while millions of stars cannot. So the point is of this verse is quality is better than quantity. Hundreds of plastic roses cannot compare to a single real rose. The holy name, one holy name chanted without offense is superior to millions chanted with offense. And so similarly, one learned son can make the whole family famous. So therefore, again, he's just stressing, therefore we must offer good education to the children. So in text 19, a person who has performed severe austerities in the holy place will have a son who is obedient, wealthy, religious, and intelligent. So now here he's pointing out how to get an intelligent son, rather how to get a good son. So a good son is born to a person who's performed severe austerities in the holy place. So we see in Srimad Bhagavatam always when very elevated devotees want to conceive a son that is like the Supreme Lord, and they go and perform austerities in a sacred place. So many examples are there. And that is the prerequisite for actually conceiving a good son. So this verse explains that good deeds performed in the past are what is required for begetting a good son. Later on, the author will establish that success comes from a combination of fate, or karma, and endeavor, and that fate is nothing but the result of past actions. Thus, a good son is born as the result of past pious activities. Vedic scriptures prescribe that one must perform Garbhadham Samskara on a proper day to conceive a good child. Purnima, Astami, and Ekadasi are considered forbidden days to conceive children. So those of you who are householders, you should take note that Purnima, Ekadasi, and Astami are not favorable days for conceiving children. One should not approach his wife during the first 4 days of her monthly period during the daytime or Brahma Muhurta. A son is born if the conception occurs on the even days. This is, of course, explained in scripture, that if after the menstruation stops, on the second, fourth, sixth, eighth days, like that, on the even numbered days, if one unites for conception, then a male child should be born. And if the parents unite for the purpose of conception on the odd numbered days, then a daughter will be born. Srimad Bhagavatam narrates the history, of course, and if the parents unite at an improper time, then of course we know from Srimad Bhagavatam that a very ill-behaved son can take birth. It's like Hiranyakasipu and Hiranyaksha, where they were conceived at an improper time. And Kamsa is another example. In the Garga Samhita, it is explained that although Kamsa is thought to be a king of, rather, he's thought to be the son, or he's known to be the son of King Ugrasena, he was actually conceived by the trick of a Gandharva named Dramila. The history is as follows. And this is in Garga Samhita. While Ugrasena's queen was visiting her father, she went to the forest one day with her friends. In that remote place, she suddenly heard someone singing who sounded just like her husband, King Ugrasena. She followed that voice and was overjoyed to find her young husband sitting under a tree singing songs indicating that he was feeling separation from her. So she approached him and he confessed that he was not able to tolerate her absence but had not sought her out at her father's house because he did not want to appear henpecked in front of him. It's actually a very embarrassing thing for the husband. If the husband, especially if he's a king, and he's so attached to his wife that when she goes away for a few days, he can't live without her, and he goes following behind her to get association. It's kind of an embarrassing thing. So she went to her father's house, so he didn't want to go there because his presence there would obviously make it apparent that he was overly attached to her. So he went into the forest, knowing she would be wandering there with her friends. Thus avoiding embarrassment, he had secretly followed her with the intent of meeting her privately. In this way, he wooed her and they united in the solitary forest. Afterwards, Ugrasena's wife became a bit suspicious and her probing forced the impostor to reveal his actual identity. And of course, he was a Gandharva named Dramila who had become attracted by her beauty and thus seduced her, and Kamsa was a result of their union. And so therefore, he was ill-conceived and consequently had these demoniac qualities. So these historical examples stress the importance of Vedic sanskaras. At present, hardly anyone observes them and the result is obvious. Sons resulting from improper union are neither obedient nor religious. Rather, such persons take pleasure in disobedience and irreligiosity. The result is the family must suffer disrespect, embarrassment, mistrust, and other distresses. So then text number 20. O King, in this material world there are six types of pleasures. 1, to obtain required wealth. 2, to have good health. 3, to have a beautiful, lovely wife. 4, to have a sweet-speaking wife. 5, to have an obedient son. And 6, to have an education that brings wealth. So these are the six things for material pleasure. There is no pleasure in the material world. So all material comforts cost money, so the first basis of material pleasure is wealth. But if one's health is poor, then wealth is futile. So good health is a prerequisite for enjoying wealth. The topmost pleasure in the material world is association with the opposite sex. Therefore, a wife is required. The author is not recommending illegal relationships or illicit relationships, but he's saying that to have a wife, a properly married wife, that is a source of pleasure. If one is healthy and wealthy but does not have a lovely, sweet-speaking wife, then he will still be frustrated. With all that, if sons are not well-behaved, one will still not be satisfied. To find such a situation is very rare. Without following the scripture, it is not possible. One can earn money by working for others, but if one is educated and knows how to acquire wealth, then he does not have to be subservient to anyone. So here the author is recommending that to have an education that brings wealth means that one is educated enough that he knows how to make enough money to maintain his life and does not have to work for other people. We know from, of course, Srila Prabhupada just explaining that this is a characteristic or a qualification of a brahmana, and that he doesn't accept employment. Or of course, a kshatriya also, he can levy taxes in exchange for protecting the his subordinates. He also cannot accept employment. And a vaishya also, he is industrious enough to make his own business and employ himself and employ the fourth class men, the sudras. So, especially for a brahmana, he cannot be in a position where he's dependent on anyone else. Otherwise, Srila Prabhupada points out that he will have to compromise religious principles. He'll have to compromise scriptural principles. If a brahmana allows himself to be to become subordinate, or rather dependent on a king or a vaishya, then he actually loses all his brahminical power. Because then if, let's say, he's dependent on the money, or the, not only money, but position, or on any of the things that the king gives him, then there's always the fear that the king will take that away if he speaks in a way which the king does not like. Actually, in Satsrupa Maharaj's book, in the first the very first part, it explains how Chanakya was such a strict brahmana that even though he was the advisor of King Chandragupta, that he lived outside the palace. Srila Prabhupada glorifies him again and again for this principle, that he lived outside the palace. He could have lived in some kind of royal opulence, but he stayed in a very meager and humble hut outside the palace and lived very simply. And once Chandragupta, the king, asked him, or he questioned, he said, "You please explain about some of your activities." In other words, Chanakya had done something that the king wanted him to explain. And so Chanakya Pandit said to him, "If I have to explain my activities to you, then I resign." Which means the brahmanas, of course, should be fully independent. They should give advice to the kings. It's not that the kings, or the kshatriyas, or the lower classes should direct them or should advise them on what to do. Because the brahmanas are the ones that have enough discipline. In the Varnashram system, everyone follows some kind of authority. Like the sudras, some sudras will be attracted to serving brahmanas or kshatriyas or vaishyas. And so they have a master from one of the higher classes. And similarly, a vaishya, he'll be attracted to making money a certain way, and he'll have to pay taxes to the king. So he has to have some king that he gives his taxes to. Similarly, the kshatriyas, who are the kings, they have an authority, and of course that's the brahmanas. They must take direction from the brahmanas and manage their kingdoms according to scriptural rules. And the brahmanas, who are their authorities? Who's the authority of the brahmanas? Huh? Shastra. Yeah. The brahmanas study the shastra, and they have the self-discipline to make themselves follow it. If they're actually brahmanas, then they don't require someone to tell them to follow it. They have that brahminical nature, which means high integrity, or we know samudamas tapasocham. They have austerity naturally, and so when they read the scriptures, and of course they're guided by their spiritual masters, then they naturally can discipline themselves to follow. So therefore, they're not, the king cannot, the laws of the state do not apply to them. So then, text 21. A house filled with many useless sons is like a pot filled with husk. Better to have one intelligent son who will support and bring fame to the family. So husk is something that's useless, at least as far as nourishing goes. It doesn't give any nourishment. Then text 22. A father who is a debtor is an enemy, and so is an unchaste mother. For the husband, a beautiful wife is an enemy, as is an illiterate son. So here, the characteristic of an enemy is that he enjoys inflicting distress on others. He may even kill. Thus, whoever inflicts distress is like an enemy. If the father borrows money and then suddenly dies, the son is obligated to pay it back. If the mother is not chaste, she will conceive illegitimate sons who will be rebellious and disturb her legitimate children. Moreover, if the mother is unchaste, the son will feel inferior in the assembly of gentlemen. And that's where in another place... Srila Prabhupada translated this verse, or he uses this verse in preaching also, saying that this, if he's also told us that if the mother accepts another husband in front of her son, then she becomes the enemy of the son. For this reason, that he, in fact, one of my friends, householder, he has some sons. He has two sons, and the husband and wife, he is separated from his wife, and the son, his son was 12 years old, and he went and told his mother, and they're devotees. He went and told his mother. He told his mother that if you let any other man in this house, I'll kill him. A 12-year-old boy is saying this. So you can see, it's not that he's read the Shastra and is saying, oh, well, the unchaste mother is an enemy. This is just actually a natural feeling that a son will not be able to tolerate seeing his mother with some other man. Or at least it will have some... And if it doesn't come out like that, then he'll repress it and it will cause some disturbance to his mind. So therefore, this should be avoided at all costs. And of course, a beautiful wife is an enemy because then the husband can become overly attached to her and then will not be determined to take up, spiritual life or renunciate. It'd be very difficult for him to renounce a beautiful wife. Therefore, when Srila Prabhupada was his marriage was being arranged, his father chose. There was two girls who were being considered for marrying Srila Prabhupada, and his father picked the one which was least attractive, and said, "You will thank me for this someday. I'm getting a wife for you who will serve you and will be chaste, but she's not so attractive, and you'll be able to break your attachment to her and take up, sannyas or take up full dedication to spiritual life." Now another thing, if one's wife is very beautiful, then other men will try to entice her. And if she's not devoted to her husband, then she will either keep a paramour or abandon him. Sometimes an unchaste wife will either arrange for the murder of her husband. Of course, if a wife is beautiful and chaste, she may not be a source of trouble. But others will be attracted to her. Just like Sita Devi was, of course, extremely chaste and attractive. But still, demoniac men like Ravana were attracted to her and abducted her and caused great trouble. If a son is not learned, he becomes a source of misery for the father and brings infamy to the family. Especially if the father is learned and the son is a dunce, then the father feels ashamed of his son. He dares not introduce him into an assembly of learned people. So then, text 23. A man endowed with good qualities is respected, irregardless of his high or low birth. Indeed, what good is a bow without a string if it is made of the finest bamboo? So this is an important verse. And that now he's pointing out how, first he's been talking about how it's important to be born in a family, a good family. But now he's saying, but more than that is of course the character of the person. If one has a good, if one is wealthy and is born in a good family, but has bad character, then his birth is considered useless. And if a person is born in a low family, but he has good character, then he's considered, his life is exemplary. So he's pointing out here how the character of the person is more important than his birth, or the behavior of a person is more important than his birth. So who can think of some examples, for example, from Srimad Bhagavatam, of a person who took birth in a low family but actually had very good quality, good character, and was respected in society. Vidura is one very good example. Whereas he was the son of Vyasadeva and one of the maidservants of Amba or Ambalika, Ambika, one of the maidservants who was attending the princess or the queens of Vrishachaurya. She was a Sudrani, and so Vidura was born of her. But because his mother was very submissive to Vyasadeva and had a very good attitude towards him, then he was blessed with very good high character, very good qualities in character. He had so much integrity that when he saw how Duryodhan was using politics to manipulate his father and to usurping the kingdom of the Pandavas, he refused to participate. And of course, being one of the members of the dynasty, he saw how much diplomacy, how much politics and intrigue was being created towards the Pandavas, who were very righteous and religious, that when he saw that there was no hope to not be implicated in it, then it's explained in Srimad Bhagavatam that he put his bow in the door and he left with nothing. He abandoned that place and he went on parikram. And it's calculated that something like 30 to 40 years he was wandering, just incognito. Nobody knew who he was. He didn't take anybody with him, and nor did he use his name and position to try to make life easy for himself. But he just wandered like so many nameless mendicants in India, from holy place to holy place. So the significance of putting the bow on the doorstep, in the doorway, is that the bow is, for a kshatriya, this is how he makes his livelihood, by defending people, by protecting others. So the bow is his means of livelihood. He can hunt, he can fight, he can defend religious principles with the bow. So his only, that's his means of livelihood. So even that he renounced, and he just went completely dependent on Krishna. And then when he returned, after 30, 40 years of wandering like a Parivrajakacharya, then he had such great power that when he came back and preached to Dhritarashtra, then it changed his heart. So another person, of course, is Vyasadeva. Vyasadeva was born, his mother was a fisherman's daughter. And who else?
Narada
Muni. His mother was a maidservant, very humble maidservant. It's not even mentioned who his father was. So here's some examples in the scripture of persons who had high character. There's another example of one devotee named, one student came to the Gurukul of Gautama Rishi. Gautama, of course, is a famous, very famous Brahmana, and he was teaching some students. So one student approached him and said, I want to learn from you. I've heard that you're an excellent teacher. I want to learn from you. So Gautama said, okay, well, what is your gotra? What is your family name? Because in the Varnashram system, just by hearing the name, then you can know what their nature is, what varna they come from. Just like nowadays we have like Sharma or Bhargava. These are names of Brahmanas. Or Singh. This is a name for Kshatriya. Agarwal or Gupta. These are names of Vaishya community. So Gautama Rishi asked him, so what is your name? What is your gotra? And then this boy said, I don't know. He said, my mother is named Jabala. I know that much. And she's had many husbands. She's gone with many men. I once asked her who my father was, and she put her head down. She said, actually, I've known many men, and I cannot say for sure who's your father. So this boy told Gautam Rishi that. He said, I can't say. All I know is I'm the son of Jabala. That's all I know. So then Gautama, of course, this is not an easy thing to say about yourself, especially when you're trying to win somebody's favor, especially when you're trying to get the favor of some teacher. So this boy said, anyway, that's what I am. That's who I am. I'm the son of Jabala. So Gautam Rishi thought very carefully and said, the boy said, his name was Satyakama, Satyakama. And so Gautam said, okay, I'll accept you as my student. You go get some firewood. You go beg some firewood now in the forest, and you bring it, and we'll perform the yajna, and I'll initiate you as my student, because I can see you have the brahminical quality of truthfulness. So the point is that because the boy spoke something which was actually very difficult to say about himself, he spoke very honestly, and he did not lie. He did not say a half-truth or try to try to hide something about himself in front of his teacher. Then Gautam Rishi noticed this boy, maybe he didn't come from a good family, but he has very high integrity. So therefore, he has good character. And that's more important than anything else. So now this is actually a very important theme that will reoccur throughout the whole Hitopadesha, the different stories that have come up. You'll see that this is a very important theme, because the author wants us to take note of human character. He wants us to train ourselves to evaluate others on the basis of their character rather than on their position within the Varnashram system. This will help avoid so many difficulties. So this verse plays a pun on Vangsa and Nirguna. Vangsa means either dynasty or bamboo. Just know, we hear Yadu Vamsa means the Yadu dynasty, or we know Vamsidari. Vamsidari means the holder of the flute. What kind of flute? Vamsi is a bamboo flute. So, Danur Vamsa Vishudopi, this is from this verse, it means a bow made from good Vamsa. Nirguna means without good qualities, and also means without a string. So just as a bow without a string, Nirguna, cannot perform its function, a son, even if born in a good family, Vangsa, is useless if not endowed with good qualities. So the author stresses the importance of good character over high birth. A high birth is advantageous, but if one's character is bad, that high birth is worthless. On the other hand, if a person is born in a low family, but has impeccable character, then he is superior. So then he gives examples of Narada Muni, Vidura, as examples of persons who have exemplary character, even though born in not so exemplary families. And the opposite, persons who were born in good families, like Hiranyakasipu, Ravana, and Kamsa, but they had bad character. Therefore, a man's good character is his best asset. Text number 24. Alas, my son, you have not studied all these nights. Thus, in the assembly of scholars, you will have to lower your head in shame. You will have to lower your head in shame, just as a cow sinks in the marshy land. So now he's finished this series of verses which discuss about the importance of being educated. So then he says, how then can my sons become meritorious? The king asks. Then text number 25, you'll see how Srila Prabhupada has used this verse, or he's drawn from this verse. Eating, sleeping, defending, and mating, these four activities are common among animals and humans. Religion is an added activity performed by humans, and without it, they are no better than animals. So human beings are uniquely endowed with the ability to speak and acquire knowledge, and are thus considered superior to all other species. Because of this special faculty, special facility, they naturally strive for superior goals, like acquiring spiritual knowledge, which culminates in understanding the Supreme Person, Lord Krishna. If they do not cultivate spiritual knowledge, they act on the animal platform. Animals are completely under the control of their body and senses and are governed by the above four natural tendencies. But a human being is expected to rise above these four, achieve self-realization and knowledge of the Supreme Lord. The Lord appears again and again to educate human beings in the scripture. Shukadev Goswami confirms this in 5th canto, 19th verse, 19th chapter, 5th verse. O Lord, you incarnate in this material world not just to kill demons, but to educate mortal beings. Human beings who do not cultivate spiritual knowledge are actually worse off than animals. They misuse the special faculty they have been given to tighten their bonds to the material world. The living entities occupying animal bodies deplete the results of their past karma. That's a living being that's inside an animal's body, then he is suffering the results of his previous karma. And every day that passes, he's becoming more and more free from that. Because he's not incurring karma. He's not creating further karma for himself. He's simply suffering the results of his past karma. Whereas a human being, we're suffering the results of our past karma, but we can also create further suffering for ourselves by irreligious activities. The animals progress as their bad karma is expended, but human beings who act only for the sake of eating, sleeping, defending, and mating add to their stock of bad karma and simply degrade themselves. Thanks to modern technology, these things may now, sinful activities may now be performed in such a way that one can accumulate more karma in this lifetime, and it will take him millions of lifetimes to work it out. In other words, just like, I know those of us who have grown up in the West, and of course the scripture explains that if you eat a cow, or if you kill a cow, or you participate in the killing of a cow, then you have to take a birth for every hair on the animal's body. So now, in the West, they have these fast food chains, or chains of fast food, where you can go in and buy a hamburger or something, and in 5 minutes, you've eaten the meat of a cow, and therefore you're guilty, or at least for part of the sin of killing a cow. And then, you know, you can spend your life like this, just eating all this fast food, which and each one from a different cow. And so you can spend 10 years eating meat that's processed like this in slaughterhouses, and consequently, and just even in a day, you can the sinful activities that one can perform because of this modern technology can pave the way towards millions and millions and millions of births in this material world. Even now, someone told me they're putting the cow's bones, they crush the cow's bones and they put it in the toothpaste. So even you think, I'm a vegetarian, you just buy some common toothpaste and you're putting the cow's bones in your mouth. Or even we, remember when Srila Prabhupada was here, we told him that the milk that we buy in the store in the West is enriched, vitamin D enriched. And the vitamin D is oil from the fish oil. It means it has fish in it. So we reported that because he told us that we should try to get milk from the dairy that is whole milk, not processed milk for the deities anyway. But what can be done? Practically everything nowadays that is processed food has some kind of, it's connected with some kind of sinful activities. So therefore modern technology is actually expediting our suffering, actually increases the amount of births we'll have to take in suffering. So now such a person who is indulging in so many sinful activities and degrading himself by accumulating more and more sinful reactions, he is the worst enemy of all species, including his own. And these persons kill innocent animals just to fill their belly and decorate their body. The result is they cause suffering for others and themselves, and though here it is said that they are equal to animals, they are actually worse than animals. Animals do not make extensive plans to exploit others, stock things. They don't need, they don't hoard food, they don't enslave other animals, nor do they encroach upon others' rights. In contrast, human beings cause terror for all other species. So then text number 26. One's life is useless if he does not attain even one of the goals of religion, economic development, sense gratification, and liberation. Dharma, artha, kama, and moksha. So the human life here is compared to the nipple-like appendages hanging from a goat's neck if that life is not dedicated to attaining some of these goals. This verse also we've heard Srila Prabhupada quote in his purport. So everything has a purpose. According to Vedic culture, human beings strive for the goals mentioned in this verse, and the Supreme Lord offers four types of shastra to guide them in this endeavor. So there's shastra, there's dharma, you know, for those who are pursuing dharma, then there's dharma shastra. For those who are pursuing artha, there's artha shastra. And for those who are performing, who are seeking kama, economic development, rather sense gratification, then there are literatures called that fit into the category of kama shastra. And then those who are looking for liberation, there are literatures which are categorized as moksha shastra. So examples of books which are dharma shastra are Manu Smriti, or rather the laws of Manu, and Hari Bhakti Vilas is also considered a dharma shastra. Hitopadesh, what we're studying now, Panchatantra, the Kautilya or Chanakya Niti, Kautilya Artha Shastra, they of course are Artha Shastra. How to, they're studied by those who want economic gain. And the Kama Sutra of Vatsyayana and the Rati Manjari, these are known to be Kama Shastras. And the Upanishads and Vedanta Sutra are Moksha Shastra. So Dharma Shastra explains the religious duties of a person according to Varna and Ashram. Artha Shastra explains the process of acquiring wealth by fair means. And it also offers instructions on proper conduct and explains how a king should manage his kingdom. Niti is part of Artha Shastra. Kama Shastra describes the process of gratifying one's desires without transgressing religious principles and should not be mistaken for pornography. Sometimes people think that Kama Sutras or Kama Shastra is actually pornographic, but therein, those instructions never encourage one to disobey the religious scriptures. The author of Kama Sutra, Vatsyayan, writes, "A man with a lifespan of 100 years should divide it into the various ashrams, brahmacharya, grihastha, vanaprastha, and sannyas, and engage in dharma, artha, and kama in such a way that the three neither become obstacles to one another nor independent of each other." This sutra, in this sutra, Vatsyayan does not prescribe unrestricted sense pleasure. One cannot expect to live 100 years if he indulges in rampant sense enjoyment. Sutra 1.2.6 prescribes that one should remain celibate during student life. Vatsyayan includes moksha within the category of dharma, as is evident from the fourth sutra in the same chapter. Later on, he explains the importance of trivarga, dharma, artha, and kama, and concludes that artha, or economic gain, is superior to kama, sense gratification, and dharma is superior to artha. The most amazing thing is that Vatsyayan was a lifelong brahmachari. It's interesting. He's a lifelong brahmachari, but he's writing the Kama Sutra, which is, you know. So, but he explains in the beginning of this work, the Kama Sutra, he explains that he writes two verses which state, "This Kama Sutra has been compiled by me while observing celibacy and while in trance. Its purpose is to teach proper human conduct, not attachment to sex." One who knows the essence of Kama Sutra and who protects dharma, artha, and kama with his dealings in society will certainly become Jitendriya, one who can control his senses. So Jitendriya, we know this is a term It's used also in Bhagavad Gita. It means he who is in the sixth chapter. Who know? Where's? What is it? You know that in the sixth chapter that verse, Paramatma Samahita. You know, Mother Narayani, it's a. For one who, it's the verse, the English is, for one who has conquered the mind, the super soul is already reached. No. For one who has conquered the mind, the super soul is already reached, for he has attained tranquility. Chittatmana prasantasya. Paramatma samahita. So chittantasya means, jitta means conquered. So one who has conquered the senses. So that, anyway, this, what Vatsyayana is doing is he's teaching, okay, if you want to enjoy your senses, okay, do so like this. And if you regulate this desire to enjoy the senses, and you follow the rules of the Grihastha Ashram, then at the end, after passing through that austerity, or that following those rules and regulations, in the end you will have control of your senses. So the Kama Shastras are meant to not encourage one just to get absorbed in sense gratification, but it teaches one how to regulate it so that at the end he's conquered the tongue, belly, and genitals. So we run out of time. And there's still more to discuss on this verse, but we'll stop here and begin again tomorrow here. Anything else? I'm sorry, I have a very bad sore throat today, so it's hard for me to... Yes, Janosh Prabhu.
There's
a danger. They may be brahminical, right? But in other words, let's say I'm a grihastha, and I have, of course, I need money to pay my bills, right? And I'm dependent on someone. Let's say I'm a brahmana, but I'm dependent on someone. Now, if my authority, whoever he may be, if my authority, then, let's take it out of the ISKCON context because I don't want anybody to get upset. But in the history of Christianity, I don't know the details, but there was. Mataji, you're familiar with Christian history? Well, there was a king, right? King James, was it? Of course, the Christians' teachings are that one should not get divorced. King Henry? Okay, Henry VIII, right? So now King Henry, he was, of course, supposed to be a Christian, but now he wanted to divorce his wife and marry someone else. So therefore, he got some so-called biblical scholars and made them translate the Bible. There's a certain version of the Bible, right? Wasn't that King James? Huh?
King James version. King Henry beheaded his
wives. Yeah, King Henry killed his wives or something.
King James changed the Bible and started the Anglican Church.
Maybe, anyway, that's... I'm sorry? Of the Pope. And anyway, this King James, he hired some scholars to translate the Bible to suit his purpose. Now, my point is, had they been brahmanas, had they not been dependent on the king or wanted something the king was offering them, they would not have done this. They would have rather died for religious principles. Rather, they would have rather died than compromise religious principles. So that's the danger. Srila Prabhupada has taught us this, that if a brahmana is dependent on someone, then if that person, for whatever reason, wants to further his opinion, then the brahmana who's dependent on him will not have the courage to resist that. And he will say, anyway, we can twist the Sanskrit to mean this way. We can take this secondary definition or whatever in order to... otherwise, if I take a hard stand on it, then he's going to take the chapati off my plate. And then, where will I go to get another chapati on my plate? And my children will also have no place to eat. Or that threat is there, that fear is there. And so, We cannot say they're not brahmanas, but we can say that they can be compromised. They're in a dangerous position because they can be compromised. That we have to say because that is a fact.
I think this more people can see this danger, but what alternative can we offer? I mean how a brahmana should exercise his
how can he maintain himself?
How can he maintain himself?
By charity, you know, by receiving charity and by teaching, like we discussed, patan yajan yajan dana pratigraha. He can teach the scripture, study the scripture, and teach the scripture, and receive charity for that. He can perform sacrifices and teach others how to perform sacrifices and receive charity for that. And then he can beg charity and give charity. So strictly speaking, these are the ways a brahmana can maintain himself, and therefore he's not dependent. If one person doesn't give him charity anyway, he can go. He has the confidence. He's learned that he can go and pick grains from the field, or he can go to the market, in the grain market, and sweep up the grains. You can jump. I've done it. You can jump on the back of one of these tractors pulling a big trailer. When they harvest the grains, you can sweep up. You can ask the guy, "I sweep up the back of your trailer." Yeah, yeah. There's all kinds of wheat. I gathered like 250 grams of wheat, which is enough for 2 days to live. So you can, if you're resourceful, if you actually are brahminical, then this is the means Krishna's given the brahmanas to subsist. He's not going. Krishna's very dear to the brahmanas. The brahmanas are very dear to Krishna, so he will maintain the brahmanas. So it requires that one has that some faith in the scripture, but that if one is actually brahminical, then he would rather starve than compromise religious principles. Yes.
So the problem of the brahmanas. What about the kshatriyas? I mean, how they are supposed to pay taxes or how they should.
They, well, in Bhagavatam it's explained, they have to protect and provide for their subjects, and in exchange for guiding them and helping them follow religious principles or follow their duties within the Varnashram system, then they have a right to tax the Vaishyas and other Kshatriyas. This is explained in the history of the chapters about King Prithu. That is, this is how a Kshatriya can make his living. But if he levies taxes and does not protect them, then he destroys himself. He's fit to be abandoned. So ultimately, the thing is that we have to learn that who's putting the chapati on their plate is not. Not our immediate authority, but it's actually Krishna. Actually, Krishna is providing for us, and therefore, we have to realize that. It's very important that we realize that if we want to uphold religious principles, we have to realize that it's not coming from this person or that person, but it's actually coming from Krishna. And therefore, if I stand up for religious principles, now I haven't missed a meal in 20 years, right? Now, if I stand up for religious principles, which is something that Krishna wants us to, his devotees to do, right? So how is it he's going to deny us what we need to maintain ourselves if we fight for religious principles? No, we should have confidence that we'll become more endeared to him if we stand up for these. If we stand up for religious principles. If we help him reestablish religious principles, that's what he comes here to do. So if we are devotees, if we're actually devotees of Krishna, then we will always choose the religious principles. We will sacrifice our comfort for religious principles. So that's what we have to do in every case. Is at least, now, one may be maintained by the temple because he's a temple president or something. He may be maintained, but he should understand very clearly this maintenance is actually is coming from Krishna. It's not coming from some other source. It may be coming through some source now, But if that is at stake for the purpose of religious principles, I should always go with the religious principle and have the faith that Krishna will provide for me through some other source. And if one who doesn't have this understanding, then he's in danger of having to compromise religious principles for his maintenance. And then this is how the disciplic session gradually becomes destroyed, broken. These people are waiting for their class. I don't want to keep them out. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.